This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today, we're going over Mystic Pizza. Beware the saxophone solos that will make your ears bleed. But fortunately, we don't have those in this episode. You just have to watch the movie if you want to listen to them. So if you haven't seen it and don't want us to ruin it for you, you may want to pass on this one, and we'll catch you next time. Are you ready for One Dry Kiss?
Yeah, and that was a musical rendition of one of the worst songs in this movie, the movie that we're doing today, which is Mystic Pizza, and I am doing it with...
I beg to differ.
What?
The worst song is the final song.
The worst song is the final song. I don't even, I didn't, I, okay, well, we,
yes,
you're going to have to sing it to me because I don't remember it.
Oh, I not do right not. Now, it, the melody is nope, not in my head. It's just a horrible, sappy song about best friends and I don't know, awfulness.
Yes, I do remember it. That's it, folks. We are doing Mystic Pizza, the movie that's chock full of sad songs about friends and saxophone solos. There's a lot of S's going on in this movie. And I will be exploring all those bad S's with my co-host, the pepperoni to my pizza, maybe my Mystic Pizza,
ooh,
Corinne Eddy.
And I am here with my co-host, the bestie, who would tell me, don't do it, girl. Don't sleep with that married man, Miss Tamara Kosio.
Well, it depends. Is he separated? Is he on his way to a divorce? Like, there's got to be some more information given in order for me to say emphatically, don't sleep with that married man. Probably would be my response, in all honesty. I do think that's what I would say, but I would need more questions. I have a milestone that I would not like to share with you.
Okay.
I started doing the 10-minute Pilates challenge.
Oh.
I've gone through one whole day of it.
Congratulations.
Since I've started. Thank you. Thank you. So the other day, I usually get on the exercise bike per my doctor's recommendation for my high blood pressure and just to get my heart rate up for like 40 minutes in the morning when I can drag myself out of bed. So on Monday, I dragged myself out of bed. I got on the exercise bike. I did my 10-minute Pilates challenge, pulled something in my wrist. That's neither here nor there. And then went to work and immediately started falling asleep at my desk, even though I had like a whole cup of coffee in me. So the very next night, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go to bed an hour earlier. Usually I go to bed at 1 o'clock in the morning. That's just my like witching hour. Or whatever, that's just like the time that my body's like, we can sleep now. And so on Tuesday, I went to bed at midnight. I was like, great, it's going to work out so good. I'm going to work out. It's going to be great. Had to go to the bathroom, as I want to do, because I'm in my mid-40s. Came back to bed, immediately was wide awake. 3 o'clock in the morning, and my mind was like, bink! So it's pretty much set in stone that I cannot go to bed early, because while I sat there for like an hour and a half, I literally designed like 3 websites in my head.
Okay.
Came up with my own jingle.
Great. What was your jingle?
I don't remember it now because I didn't write it down.
Ugh, so disappointed.
I'm just saying, like, I was trying to do the right thing. I'm like, I'm going to get healthy. I'm going to exercise. I'm too tired after I exercise. I'm going to go to bed early. My body's like, nope, you are not. Guess what? So then, long story short, which is impossible now because it's already a long story, I finally fell asleep and then slept late because I was up for like an hour and a half in the middle of the night. Didn't wind up working out at all. So it was disappointing.
Oh, so no Pilates challenge. No 10-minute Pilates challenge.
Well, that was 2 days ago. So okay. I'm like, I did get on the exercise bike this morning. I did not do the Pilates challenge because, again, I messed up my wrist. I don't know how I could mess up my wrist when my legs are up on a wall, but it happened. I don't know. Maybe when I was getting down too vigorously or something. Anywho, I was regaling my cousin with this little story, and she was like, you just got to get up and start working on those websites when they come to you. And I was like, that is a good point, because when I get home and I'm drained, I'm like, I don't want to do anything.
Yeah.
But 3 o'clock in the morning, if the mood's grabbing you, you got to go with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was very responsible. You did your 10-minute Pilates challenge. last night. I did a little choppy choppy. I did a little pourry pourry, and I had a container with carrot sticks, celery sticks, little snap peas, and apples. And then I had a little container with peanut butter, another little container with ranch, and another little container with hummus. And so I had delicious, healthy snacks, and I got some vegetables into my diet today. And also, I need to be in a self-help program for Nerds Clusters, too. So there was that as well.
So you were doing meal preps. You were prepping your meals?
It was just prepping snackies. Snackies.
Prep snack preppies.
Yeah.
Snack preppies. Good. You got your greens in along with your multicolored gummy candies, I'm assuming.
Yes.
A little the garnish. Rainbow.
I was eating the rainbow. Yes.
Yeah, they do say you have to eat all the colors.
Yeah.
So I guess you can get it all done in one swoop if you eat some Nerds Clusters.
Exactly. That's true. Exactly. Had healthy snacks.
That's what I'm going to argue next time my doctor tells me that. You need to eat a myriad of colored foods when you eat. That is good for you. All right, let me just get some Nerd Clusters, buy them in bulk. We're all good. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Doc. So, Corinne.
Yes?
Can I ask, you've seen Mystic Pizza before.
Oh, yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. And so you would share my assessment that the music is bad, and also that Julia Roberts, a.k.a. Daisy, should be my hair spirit animal in this movie.
I mean, I definitely think that Julia Roberts' hair was glorious in it, and that you are definitely channeling Julia Roberts' hair for sure. I didn't remember the music at all, and as I was watching it this time, I was like, yes, Tamara is spot on. Boy howdy, the music in this movie is shitty. As I was like watching another montage with saxophone accompaniment, and I was like, why the saxophone, why? Yes.
Yeah,
so
oh god, yeah. It's like the music directors that were working on these shows, like, I don't think they just got soundtracks and existing songs. They're like, I could make something that's better, something that'll win a Grammy. No, it won't. Just just narrow down your hopes and make it palatable. Don't shoot for those stars, because you're going to miss. Not all of them, just some of them. Mm-hmm. And a lot, actually not some of them, like a lot of those 80s movies that had like their own self-made soundtracks. I think The Lost Boys was another one where they had like this punk band guy with no shirt on that was super built and a mohawk, like really rocking out on the saxophone. It was like a Santa Cruz Beach boardwalk concert at night, and this guy was gyrating against his saxophone and like really and just was like everybody was cheering, and I was like, I wouldn't even like that back in the 80s. Like, I don't know why they're so excited. I don't get it. I don't get it. But enough about the music, Corinne.
Yes.
Like, let's dive into the whole entire movie, Corinne. Do you have a synopsis?
Oh, do I have a synopsis? Yes. Yes, I do have a synopsis.
I know, and you did it ahead of time. I was so proud.
Thank you. 10 minutes later. Okay, are we ready? No. You're like, well, I don't need to cover the movie anymore. Thank you. Yes.
No, I'm just kidding. Yes, and that was our show. We're doing a super short one today. Thanks, Corinne.
In the seaside town of Mystic, Connecticut, is the legendary pizza place Mystic Pizza, owned by Leona and Mr. Leona. But we get very little insight into their life because this movie isn't about them. It's about three of their employees, Jojo, played by Lily Taylor, Daisy, played by Julia Roberts, and Kat, played by Annabeth Gish. The trio are at a pivotal moment in their lives during the fall of 1988. Jojo is trying to figure out if it's possible for her to get married and maintain her sense of self, which is resulting in a major case of cold feet to her fiancé, Bill, played by Vincent D'Onofrio. Daisy, big sister to Kat, is trying to figure out what the fuck to do with her life. And is it a good idea to go out with the overprivileged rich guy who has dropped out of school and whose parents own a summer house in town? Question mark, question mark. And finally, Cat. Sweet, sweet Cat. Played by Annabeth Gish.
She's really played by Annabeth Gish.
Yes.
Annabeth Gish plays the shit out of Cat.
Was somewhere between 16 and 17 years old when this was filmed. She is a smarty who has her shit together. She's going to Yale in the new year and working all the jobs to help raise money for her tuition. However, in spite of her laser focus, she is not immune from growing pains either. She ends up nannying the 4-year-old daughter of a hunky architect whose wife is away on business in London. Her connection with him is undeniable. And in spite of Tamara and I yelling at her, "Don't do it, girl, don't do it!" Sometimes there are life lessons that one just has to learn on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sadly, yes. Mm-hmm. Will JoJo end up finally making her way down the aisle on the back of a white unicorn? Will Daisy steal the rich guy's Porsche, sell it, and retire off the proceeds? Will Kat decide that Yale is not for her and end up running off with a married man? Keep those listening ears listening to find out.
Whew, there's a lot going on in this movie.
Yeah.
Said very well, Corinne.
Thank you.
Wrapping up that synopsis.
And Tamara?
Yes.
Are you ready to start us off on the journey? Grab a slice from Mystic Pizza and chomp into the deliciousness that is this movie.
Yes. Yes, I am. Wow, 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 wow. That's me pretending to chomp. Wow, 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 wow.
That was beautiful. That is how she eats, gentle listeners. Whenever I'm with her, it's a little awkward because she's like, ah, la, 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 la.
And I'm la, 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 la.
Okay. Okay.
Food falling out of my mouth. Not really good when you're eating soup, but still I try.
It's kind
sound
of like
effects.
Being with the Cookie Monster.
Full frontal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ah, here we go. We open with a photo montage of three girls, some noticeably and terribly photoshopped, even though I don't think Photoshop was around then. They are Daisy, played by Julia Roberts, her sister Kat, played by Annabeth Gish, and their best friend JoJo, played by Lily Taylor. The pictures show them growing up through the years, and we end the slideshow at a little white church in the seaside town of Mystic, Connecticut. Kat and Daisy slowly march down the aisle in pink satin bridesmaid dresses and baby's breath in their hair. Ah, the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Followed by Leona, the matron of honor. They all pass Bill, played by a young, very hot Vincent D'Onofrio. And I had a crush on Vincent D'Onofrio for the longest time. And after seeing him in such hits like The Cell, when he was like basically the devil, I was like, what did I see in him? Like, how did I think that he was attractive? And then we go back to Mystic Pizza, and then I'm like, oh, yes, there it is. This movie. He is in a tux, smiling and eagerly looking down the aisle. Who's he waiting for? It's JoJo. She's being given away by her blue ruffle tuxed father, and she don't look so good. She slowly makes her way down the aisle, peering at the smiley faces before getting to her soon-to-be husband. They kneel in front of the priest who begins declaring loudly to the packed pews that marriage is forever until you take your last breath, and its sanctity can't be broken lest you wind up in hell. It's all too much for Joe. Her eyes roll into the back of her head, and she passes the fuck out in front of God and everyone.
Oh, just because you pass out don't mean you can't get married. However, cut to Cat.
Hey, it's got to be consensual. It's got to be like sex. You can't just be like, yes, it's okay, move their mouth while they're passed out cold.
I'm just imagining Harrison Ford in Working Girl with the passed out Melanie Griffith being like, okay, we're tying the knot now.
I'm sure there'd be many a married couple in Vegas with people that, no. I'm just going to stop that.
Yes.
No.
Dark place. So, cut to Kat and Daisy waiting tables at Mystic Pizza, a rustic joint whose motto is, every slice is a slice of heaven. Kat almost barrels into her sister Daisy, who loudly complains, watch out, you think I have eyes on my butt? Kat retorts, dunno, that's where your brains are. In the short waitressing scene, we get a sense that Daisy is the foul-mouthed, sexy one who's got her sights on a brown-haired, yummy-looking yuppie that she notices driving by the restaurant in a sweet, sweet convertible Porsche. Yeah, that's exactly.
That was my impression of the Porsche.
Oh, well, then we're keeping that in. Great. I didn't know they sounded like that.
It's the roar of the engine.
While her sister Kat is the smarter, reserved, responsible one. In the kitchen are their tough but fair bosses, Leona and her husband, Mr. Leona. That's what we're calling him anyways, because, yeah, he doesn't have a name in this. And that's why we're calling him Mr. Leona. Where they make pizza magic happen. Their restaurant is like a work family, and the bosses love their waitresses like daughters. Everyone is surprised when Jo rushes through the restaurant door in her work uniform. Daisy asks, "What are you doing here? You're not on the schedule." And Jo admits, "I had to get out of the house from my family. My father blew $5,000, $12,900 in today's money, to see me pass out at the church."
No. Oh my God. I love that. Today's conversion. Yes.
"He is not very happy with me right now." She puts on an apron while describing how in church, before she passed out, "I saw my life 10 years from now. I was fat and there were kids crawling all over me while I picked fish scales out of Bill's boots." Jo practically shudders while the girls ask how Bill is taking it. And Jo says, "I don't know. He's not talking to me." The door jingles. Zhing, zhing. And Daisy says, "Well, get ready to talk, because here comes Bill." A group of local guys sitting at the counter tease him by humming the wedding march, which causes Bill to lunge at all of them. But Jo gets in between them and practically drags her jilted man outside,
where he demands answers. But first off, I want to just give a gracious 80s nod to Joe's outfit in this scene, because it is quintessentially 80s, but I would still wear something like this to this day, even though she's got her black Mystic Pizza work shirt tucked into a very large elastic belt. Like, it was almost like the 80s equivalent to a waist cincher.
Yeah.
Because it, like, sucked everything in from your, like, tits to your torso. And then she had, like, a little short black mini skirt and some black stockings. Ooh. With some little flats. It was pretty cute. Oh, and wait, no, it wasn't a black miniskirt. It was like a velvet, purpley, flowery, like, miniskirt, and then tights underneath it. And I was like, you know, for 80s attire, I still could rock that. I do like that outfit. Mm-hmm. Just had to point that out and give her props. Oh, and a banana clip. She had a banana clip in her hair.
Jo had the most quintessential 80s hair throughout this entire movie. She frequently was wearing her hair up with a scrunchie and, you know, she had the accoutrement, whereas Daisy was rocking full curls, but they weren't full 80s style. And Kat was...
No, they weren't crunchy enough.
Yeah, crunchy enough, big enough, like teased out enough. Mm. And Kat was rocking... Kat was me. Kat... Like,
yeah, she was wearing, say, Kat had Corinne hair.
Corinne hair. Bob. She had a bob. Good. We're good. Yeah. And throughout this movie, I cried several times on behalf of my inner cat. So, yes. but Jojo was quintessential 80s. Loved her looks.
Yes. And I did have to watch her because she was talking pretty emphatically to Bill during the scene. And the reason why, gentle listeners, you don't see banana clips hardly ever anymore is because they did not stay. Oh. You would put your hair up in it and you think it was just going to be like Fort Knox, like nothing's getting out of this bitch. But no, they would slowly slide down and then eventually just fall right out of your hair. Tried them, wanted it to work out. It did not.
We all have our hopes and dreams.
But anyways, yes. Banana clips. Banana clips!
Why do you betray me so?
Bill asks, "What happened, Jo? Don't you want to marry me?" She tells him she does, but just couldn't do it. Once she was in the church, her cold feet wouldn't let her. But she still really, really loves him. Her words soften his anger and they kiss and make up. He asks if she's okay now, and when she confirms she is, he immediately proposes another wedding date. She freezes and then asks, oh, can we talk about this later? Back inside, Daisy is pushing her sister out the door with their Ma's pizza. Kat protests, I've already been there 3 times this week. Daisy hands her the pie and playfully says, well, when you get to 4, you go to heaven. Kat reluctantly obliges, and once she's gone, Daisy sardonically says, that cat is such a good girl. Where did they go wrong with Daisy? Leona informs her that she'll go far if she starts using her head, and Daisy glides out of the kitchen, assuring her boss, I won't be slinging this pizza forever, causing Leona to shout, the best pizza! And then we see Kat whipping through town on her scooter. She gets to the marina where her mother's working the line, banding lobster claws that were brought in off the boat. When she sees Kat, she brags to all her coworkers that her daughter is so smart and such a hard worker. She's got a partial scholarship to Yale and is working 4 jobs to save up money. Ma asks Kat if she'd like to stay for lunch and share the pizza, but she can't. She's got a job interview for a babysitting gig across town. Is she working on job number 5 then? That's what I want to know.
Ugh, when I watched Mystic Pizza back in the day, and I don't know how accurate this is, but Daisy always reminded me of your sister.
Yep, yep, that's pretty, yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that's kind of accurate.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways and not accurate in a lot of ways.
Yeah. One, the way she's just like, oh, no, you'll take care of it. Like, the way she sets up her sister, yeah. I was like, yeah. And there's a certain feisty, free-spirited element to her that I felt like was on point as well.
Well, that's usually the little sister bear to cross, that you get picked on and bossed around by your big sister. So, hey, checks out. Daisy's Kat's big sister. Denise was my big sister. Yep. I can tell you all the things that she made me do that I didn't want to do, but she was like, yeah, do it. I'm like, okay.
I'm like, my sister was the responsible one. I was the irresponsible one. So it did not go down that way at all between the two of us. Plus, I also wasn't interested in it. No, in some ways I did want to like hang out with her and spend time with her, but also, you know, I wasn't above like throwing stuffed animals at her and being like, leave me alone. So, Kat gets the address of her interview, and it's an old wood shingled colonial house on the water. She knocks on the door and is greeted by Tim Travers, a classically good looking guy who has serial killer glasses that are supposed to mask his good looks. He looks like every Lifetime movie villain from 90s movies.
Yes. So it's so true.
Yeah.
And he was the prequel to those Lifetime movies. But you be goddamn sure that when I saw him, I'm like, is he going to kill her?
Yes.
Is he going to murder her and stick him in his colonial style wood shingled house's backyard?
And I was like, he's dreamy.
You say that about all the guys, Corinne.
It's true, but this was one of my sexual awakening movies, and he was the man.
Oh.
The whole plot line between him and Kat, I was like, bleak, bleak, bleak. It's so romantic.
Oh. That's so telling because you liked the quintessential schoolish kind of glass wearing architect. And I was like, look at Bill, the longshoreman guy. He's hot. We each have our types.
Yeah. He was not on my radar at all.
And I was like, I wondered why I liked Vincent D'Onofrio. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's why.
Tim Travers is also an architect, which is a sexy quality as well.
So another, it's better than a longshoreman.
I would say a longshoreman has a certain level of hotness, perhaps, though.
And stinkiness.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. A little more odorific than an architect.
Mm-hmm.
He's new to the area, and inside, Kat is immediately drawn to an old nautical Van Cort telescope that's in the living room and tells Tim that, I'm going to study astronomy at Yale next semester. He's surprised and informs her that he's a Yale alumni too, class of 79. Annabeth Gish, who's the actress, was born in 71, FYI. So when she was 8, he graduated, ostensibly. Tim bounds up the stairs to fetch his daughter. Her name is Phoebe, and she's painfully shy when he tries to introduce them. She hides behind her dad's leg when Kat asks how old she is, and Phoebe timidly says, 6. Tim corrects her. No, you're not. You're 4. I apologize. She's had a tough week since my wife left for England. That's why you're here. I just need someone who can help part-time until my wife returns. The phone rings and Tim excuses himself to answer it with Phoebe in tow. He's on the phone for a few seconds and is rightfully outraged by a homeowner he is doing some work for demanding glass brick. Can we have a more 80s architectural feature than glass brick? And how soon did glass brick go out of style? Oh, it was in style in 88 and then went out of style in 89.
I would beg to differ. I think it went out of style about 2 minutes after it was created. Once somebody put it up, they're like, glass brick, that sounds glamorous. And then they put it up in their home and they're like, oh no, never mind. Can we? No, that looks hideous. And you can see through it. Great. Not a great option for my bathroom wall. Shit.
I actually know a couple who intentionally put glass brick in their bathroom. You cannot see through it, like, at all. But it, you know, it let a lot of light in and no fresh air. So, yes.
Was it like that you can see, like, a blobby silhouette and you're like, oh, somebody's in there. I can't tell what they're doing, but they're, oh, no, that would still make me very uncomfortable. Like, oh, they're tall. Now they're small. Well, they're definitely on the toilet. We know that. Like, that's still, like, you basically get the gist. And I do not need visuals to go with whatever you're doing in there, whether it's showering or shitting.
It's only the gist when you're showering. When you're shitting, there's a shower curtain there that covers the area. So, you know.
I'm still against it. You just sound like you're defending the glass brick grin. I am still very much against it. Bathroom or anywhere.
Okay. Note to self, cancel the order of glass bricks to Tamara's apartment. Check.
Oh, you can just keep them coming. I'll just go over to your apartment and start throwing them at you.
Oh! Glass brick is heavy and hurts. That's not cool. That's not cool at all. So I say to the woman who is trying to get glass brick in their house, don't do it, girl. Don't do it. But Kat is not on that page. She is trying to figure out how to woo Phoebe. So Kat spies a picture book, shows it to Phoebe, and sits down pretending to read it. This piques the little girl's interest, and Phoebe gradually wanders over, getting closer and closer and closer. By the time Tim is off the phone, Phoebe is nestled close to Kat as she reads to her. Oh, fuck, I forgot to ask my mom.
What?
I was going to ask her how old she was when she first started babysitting. Mom!
Call her! Call her! Barbara Cameo! Barbara Cameo!
Let's see here. See if she'll answer her phone.
Hello?
Hi, Mom! This is your daughter.
I was just answering your babysitting question and then you called.
That's because Tamara demanded. She's like, call her! Call her!
Tell her why.
Does this have something to do with your podcast?
Yes. Because in the movie Mystic Pizza, Annabeth Gish, who plays Kat, when she's with the sexy teacher architect guy who she's nannying for, she tells him that she started babysitting at the age of 9. And Tam made a comment about child labor and the appropriateness of children babysitting children.
Yeah.
Oh, did I? Yes, I did. Yeah, oh, I did. I did.
I may have done a couple of times when I was 10, but never 9.
Okay.
Oh, see, that's the proper name. That's the proper age.
for that same person, I was also ironing for her.
Oh, wow.
And she would make me watch soap operas because she said that was the best improv acting around. So she put on soap operas when I was ironing for her.
Oh, my God.
Wow. So you ironed and babysat, but she was home?
Usually I wouldn't be ironing when I was babysitting, but she would be home when I was ironing.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm surprised that that didn't lead you to a career as an improv actor.
I know. Well, but drama was part of my my major, you might remember.
And she excels at acting.
Okay. Well, then, I didn't know about that. I've been missing out on the theater that happens at the Edding household.
Uh-huh.
Are you going to tell your mother that she's on our podcast?
I'm just going to say, I just can't wait to see your next post on Instagram.
Because, Tim, Mom is like, she reads your posts and is like, oh my God, what are you saying about me? And I'm like, it's nothing bad, Mom, I swear.
Right.
Wow.
We've mentioned all parents. You're an easier mention because it's less rot. It's more just a simple, yeah, she does the expected actual parenting kind of things that a person does.
And she's a phone call away.
Yeah, or like giving her daughter an ovulation thermometer.
Right? Yes.
Expected.
Oh. All right, well, I have to go, but thank you so much for answering my call.
Give her our regards to Tamara.
I will give your regards to Tamara. All right, love you.
Happy trails.
Bye.
Bye.
That was so worth it.
Oh, my mom responded, no comment, laughy face emoji.
Oh, see? It was worth it to give her a call because then we got the dirty deals, like the real scoop, the irony story, and the soap opera, the fourth soap opera watching.
Oh, my gosh.
I was like, good luck finding your spot after that.
So apparently my mom was babysitting at the age of 10. I was babysitting by the age of 13 or 14.
You got to be at least in the double digits. If you're going to watch another child in a single digits, you have to be at least double digits.
I think that's a pretty good rule of thumb. Double digits. Yeah. So Tim asks, what else do I need to know about you? Any mental illness in the family? She nods stoically and says, yes, but they say it skips a generation. This makes him smile and he asks when she can start. Phoebe points at the book and demands, read, Kat says, anytime. And Tim motions towards the book and says, you're hired. By all means, keep reading. And she does.
And while Kat's babysitting, Joe, Bill, Daisy, and Johnny McLocal guy, because we never find out his name, all hit up the local watering hole. It seems to be a typical evening until Mr. Yuppy Yummy Porsche guy waltzes into their bar with two girls who are named Carrie and Lorna. And I'm just putting that out there because it's going to be very hard to get through the scene without naming people.
Oh, did you name them?
No, their names are actually Carrie and Lorna, which is weird because I learned their name very quickly. But Yummy Yuppy Porsche guy was like a little bit harder. So I had to watch the scene again. And I finally like figured out, oh, that's where they say his name, which is a very teeny tiny part. But the guy's totally like, Lorna, Carrie. They say that quite a bit in this scene. So, anyways, this foursome looked like they just stepped out of the 80s J. Crew catalog. When they get drinks, all eyes are on them, including Daisy. Joe saddles up to her next friend and whispers, oh, he's cute. Yeah, Daisy agrees. If you like white bread, Joe adds, handsome white bread, and they both smirk. Meanwhile, preppy Porsche guy says he needs some action and makes his way to a dartboard. He bets two local dudes $10 that he can hit three bullseyes in a row. The townies up the ante to $50, and he has to take a shot of tequila between each throw. That's not how alcohol works, and some truly epically bad music is playing in the background. It is an original score made specifically for Mystic Pizza, I imagine, that goes, "Is it hot in here? Or is it just me? Can you feel the heat? Or is it just me?" Yeah. That really sets the mood.
Ooh, I'm feeling it. So sultry.
You're feeling the heat?
Yes.
Is it?
It's so hot,
is it
in
hot
here.
In here, or is it just me?
You know, yeah. I am perimenopausal, so I would say it probably is just me.
So 80s Corona would be like, "Is it hot in here?" And then 2023 Corona would be like, "Is it hot in here?
Yeah.
I feel hot. And you feel hot?
I feel like I'm glowing up a little bit here." Yeah.
Preppy guy is game to the gamble and makes the first two bullseyes easily between shots. He then notices Daisy, who gives him a sly smile, and he tips his last tequila shot in her direction. But she must have flustered him, or he somehow mainlined the tequila and is already drunk, because he fully misses the last shot by a lot. The local guys cheer at their victory, and Preppy Guy changes games to pool. He tries coaxing the girls to play boy-girl, but Leona refuses, because I'm just awful at pool. Carrie is also reluctant and asks, "If we wanted to play pool, why didn't we just do it at my house?" I was like, "'Cause of course these people all have pool tables in their house."
Obviously.
But she finally agrees, leaving Mr. Prepster to find a new girl partner. He beelines straight towards Daisy and asks if she plays. She gives him a nonchalant, "Yeah." And the game is afoot. The guys go first, then Carrie takes a turn and misses. Her beau assures her that, "It's fine, honey, that's why we play boy-girl, to even it out."
Okay, barfy, 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 barfy?
Yes. Yeah, no, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was like, excuse me? Wait.
80s.
Daisy is going to make you fucking eat your words.
Corinne, it was the 80s. They didn't know any better.
Oh, Daisy knows better. Mm. She is going to, like, shove
Daisy
that...
does.
Pull Q up his ass.
Wait, and she does. And he waddles out of there. Just kidding. No, actually. But they underestimate Daisy because she makes every single fucking shot and clears the table.
Yeah.
This pisses Lorna off and she calls Daisy a hustler. Her friends are appalled and she innocently says, "Isn't that right, Charlie? Like from the pool movie." She doesn't agree with her, and Lorna and her bruised ego ask to leave because she is done. The prepster thanks Daisy for the game and leaves. And for some reason, after they go, Daisy slumps into a stool and mutters, "Shit." And I didn't get that. I'm like, why does she say shit like something bad just happened? Like, I don't know.
I have an answer. It's in my comment on the side in my notes.
What is it?
Because she was I fucking Charlie, felt a connection, and as a local, she knows better than to get involved with the rich summer folk.
Oh, but then she shouldn't be eye fucking him through the window as he drives past in his Porsche. She should be like, "Reet, reet, reet," and doing the sign of the cross and hightailing it the other way.
Yeah, but seeing someone from a distance and just being like, excuse me, that's not the sound of a Porsche.
Shut up.
And being like, oh, hey there, sailor, is a lot different than, like, interacting with them.
Got it.
The next morning, Kat and her mother come home from church. As soon as they're through the front door, Mom yells upstairs, "Daisy, you going to the 11 o'clock mass?" She lies, yelling back, "I went last night." So Mom instructs her to come downstairs and help with lunch. Daisy flippantly says, "Kat will do it." Her sister is about to protest when Daisy peers down the banister, whispering to Kat, "Is she gone?" And then gliding down the stairs in a tight, strapless, black dress with a, you know it's the fucking 80s because there is a big white bow in the front. As Sin from Working Girl remarked, "It needs some bows or something." She got the bow right there.
She got all the bow. She got enough bow for a couple of dresses.
That bow goes on top of a car, like when it's given as a gift. The tank's still dangling off the back, and Kat grabs it and balks. You paid $160 for this? That's $413 in today's money. Daisy tells her sister, no, because I'm going to return it after I wear it somewhere. Mom hollers for help in the kitchen and Kat reluctantly goes while Daisy glides back upstairs to take off the dress. Like that, I felt was like a very Denise moment that would happen, you know?
Yeah. She's like, come help with lunch. Oh, I got to go over here and do something else other than that. Tam, yes. You can do it, right?
I guess so.
First, let me show you this cute thing that I got. Then I will be returning. A short while later, Kat is on Phoebe duty, babysitting the little girl while her dad works remodeling a home. Kat and Phoebe make a special trip to his job site, and it winds up that he is redoing a historic Cape Cod-style home that he really does not want to put glass tile in. Thank you very much. He asks Kat if she'd like a tour, and she happily jumps in at the chance because she's always wanted to see inside of this place. As they climb the stairs, he regales her with the house's sad history. This house was built in 1880 by a wealthy merchant named Elias Montrose for his bride, Elizabeth. They were married in London after a whirlwind romance. They get to the third floor and Tim leads her onto an unfinished deck overlooking the ocean. She's impressed and gushes over all the places that she would put a telescope on it. Tim continues, this is where Elias Montrose came to watch his ships, but the story has a sad ending. Tim comes closer and stands right next to Kat before finishing his story. His new wife's boat never made it back. She was lost at sea, and poor Elias spent the rest of his years standing on this balcony waiting for her. Some people say you can still hear his ghost up here, or it could be Tim shifts his weight and a board creaks. This loose floorboard. Kat is completely charmed by the story and his, hey there, looks that he is giving her, and quietly asks, you gonna fix it? He smiles at her and shakes his head. I wouldn't think of it. And there's not a kiss tractor beam. There's a high vibe flirtation tractor beam happening. Mm. I didn't feel like there was a kiss happening, but there were vibes. There were vibes.
So you said that Kat's supposed to be like 16 or 17 in this movie, or she's older, right?
I think that she's supposed to be like 17, 18 in this movie.
Okay, then that's a statutory rape vibe you're feeling.
Yeah, well, you know, I just feel like Tim, as much as I found him to be a hot, sexy piece of man back when I watched this as a teenager, I now look at it and I think, oh, he's fucking breadcrumbing her and, like, being a total asshole. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, creep. Creep is what I actually...
He is looking to prey on a young girl that doesn't know any better.
Exactly. And yet still, I get the flutters watching it. And I'm like, no, Corinne, no! Don't do it, girl! Yes. Don't do it!
Be still your loins, Corinne. Be still!
I know! Gosh darn it. It explains so many inappropriate relationships I had as a teenager.
Damn, we still blame the 80s movies for all our inappropriate relationships. 100%
I blame the 80s movies. Are you kidding me? They romanticized the shit out of that stuff.
Then we cut to later that evening where Kat, Daisy, and JoJo are getting into small town shenanigans. Jo leads her two friends down to the docks to Bill's boat because as a wedding present, he renamed his boat the JoJo. And has it painted on the back. Daisy finds a 6-pack of beer tied to the JoJo boat cooling in the seawater and steals it. Against JoJo's wishes, because those are for the hardworking guys. But since they have beers, they might as well drink. And Jo waxes poetic about Bill's hot body, especially his wrists, which are so thick and strong. They all laugh until a shooting star flies above them. And Jo exclaims, look, Kat, a comet. Cat corrects her that it's a shooting star because of the tail. She begins explaining the differences between the tails to her bestie when Daisy comes in forehead first. Is she intoxicated? She took her first sip of beer a minute ago, and that, again, is not how alcohol works. We're going to assume they did some pre-peer drinking. Daisy, conspiratorially, and I'm a little drunk and slurrily, says, "Comets look like sperm. Big sperm, and Cat has one on her ceiling that she sleeps underneath every night." She begins laughing because this last bit of info truly tickles her, since her sister is such a goody-goody. But Joe plays devil's advocate and says, "Cat is going to be a famous astronomer someday, and where are you going to be?" This doesn't dampen Daisy's spirit, but her words come off slightly clipped and cynical. She points her beer can at Joe. "You have Bill!" She points her beer can at Cat. "You have brains." She points the can to herself and smiles. "I got this." She lifts the remaining beers in the air and slurs a little. "And I got these, and to hell with all of you." She laughs manically and runs off to the pier towards the shore. Cat and Joe take the bait and chase her towards land.
Oh, good times getting drunk on starry nights. And I think
it's like that's what the thing that kills me about this 80s is, because like they drink a beer and then they're like, "Let me tell you something," and I'm like, "You took a sip." Like, it takes you like 20 minutes, 15-20, depending on how much you drink and how fast you drink. It doesn't go like that. Whether you're taking shots between tequila or sipping beers on the pier, come on, Mystic Pizza.
I just am going to say that JoJo had every right to the beer, because that boat is named after her. That beer is hers as well.
Anything on the JoJo boat belongs to the JoJo.
Yes, and also magic beer gets you drunk real fast, even though it was light beer, which I have heard gets you drunk way less fast, but I don't know. I've never had it.
Maybe it's the magic mixture of being in the seawater that makes it like extra potent.
I mean, not to sound like Cat or anything, but it's really when you're well above sea level. So like if you're in Colorado, that's when you get extra potent, not down at sea level. Yeah.
Said the girl who has not drank before in her life.
I know from friends talking about it. Thank you very much. The next day, Daisy comes home from work and is surprised to find Charles, a.k.a. Preppy, a.k.a. Pushboy, a.k.a. I Suck at Gambling guy, in her living room talking with her mom. He hasn't made a good impression because he mispronounced Mrs. Arujo's name by calling her Mrs. Arujo. I'm like, how he got that, I don't know. And she corrects him. She says, "Arujo."
They are Portuguese, by the way.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a single Portuguese person in this movie, but yes, they're supposed to be Portuguese.
They're playing Portuguese people.
Yes. And then Charlie proceeds to curse in her house in an attempt to be charming by saying, "My dad owns an old house, too. Every winter, the pipes burst, and it pisses him off." When Mom sees Daisy, she says accusingly, "I didn't know you were going to be going out tonight." Daisy didn't either, and says so, but Mom doesn't believe her and retreats into the kitchen, grumbling about Daisy's curfew. Why can't she just eat at home? They got tons of lobster in the fridge. Tons of lobster. You know how much lobster is in the fridge, Tim?
How many lobsters are in the fridge?
Yeah, you know how much lobster's in the fridge? So much lobster. Lobster for days.
Like 6 or 7, I think. The one thing I don't understand is that they say, like, I thought they kept lobster alive and then cooked it and you served it immediately because it goes bad so fast. And those lobsters are pre-cooked, so they're just chilling in the fridge. Like, how long have they been in there and are they okay to still eat?
I don't know. I don't know anything about lobster. All I know is that they're perfect for doing a little puppet show with. With all the lobsters, You can do a really good puppet show with them.
You and your puppet shows. I think this is like the third time you've mentioned puppet shows.
You could even do a Mystic Pizza version of a lobster Mystic Pizza version of Mystic Pizza with all the lobsters in the fridge.
Wow. I'd like to see that. I would pay money to see that, Corinne.
I'm seeing it now. We got like
corn silk on the hair for the hairs and the little scrunchies. And I mean, it's going to be amazing.
Sure.
Once Mom is gone and Tamara's confidence in me is gone, Daisy learns that his name is Charles Gordon Windsor Jr., or Charlie for short. It took him quite a while to track Daisy down, and he thinks Daisy's mom needs a drink because she's so tightly wound. Really? Really? Do you really want to say? Mm-hmm. Do you really want to say that?
He did.
I got my I don't like that statement look face on my face. Corinne disapproves. This causes Daisy to chuckle before telling him to sit while pushing him down into an armchair and adding, "Stay there, I'll be right with you." She saunters up the stairs and his eyes follow her the whole way. It's clear he's not used to such a confident woman.
It's a couple of things about this section.
Yes.
First off, this is the reason why I had to go back and watch the fucking pool scene again, because I'm like, how does she know his name? Because she's just like, your name's Charlie. And then he's like, Charles Gordon Windsor Jr. And I'm like, when did you learn his name? Was there like a scene that was cut? But there's like a very small section in the pool hall. This is neither here nor there. That Lorna said his name when she was like, Charlie, isn't that right? And then how the fuck did he find where she lived? Like, he didn't know her name. Was he just like asking the local towny people like, hey, where's that big red hairs girl's house or something or other? And that's not creepy at all. I mean, I guess that's the only way you would get to know somebody in the 80s, because there was no like social media or anything like that.
I had a guy who I met like on the streets of San Jose who used the pickup line. Do you have a quarter? Because my mom told me to give her a call when I saw an angel, right? He used that pickup line on me.
And oh my God.
We like had a little bit of a flirtation with each other for a short period of time. Parted ways. Years later, he calls my Uncle Tim because my Uncle Tim was in the phone book looking for me.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, that's creepy.
I was like, no. My Uncle Tim did not give out my phone number, by the way. And now there aren't phone books anymore, so. Ta-da.
Oh, and then also before this next part, this is when the wicked fucking sax solo comes on. So let me set the mood for you, Corinne.
Wow, that's so passionate, Tam. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If I had done the opening song, I would have done a sax solo in between. So thank you for the intro of the sax solo. Just imagine it. Listen to that beautiful sound. Well, I say a short while later, they leave in Charlie's red Porsche with the top down. Daisy is wearing the $160 dress. This is her somewhere. And they cruise through town. But the minute they get into the forested outskirts, they get a flat. Daisy tells Charlie to put on the spare, but he laughs entirely too hard and informs her that was the spare. And I'm like, seriously, you rich dick? Like, you got all this money and you're going around on your spare? Anywho, they manage to get a convertible rabbit's worth of college-aged girls to stop and pick them up when Charlie drops his pants as a last-ditch attempt to sultrily hitchhike. They laugh, stop the car, and pick them both up. Next, we see Daisy and Charlie finishing their dinner at a restaurant. They clearly close down the place because it is completely empty and the waiters are quietly clearing tables around them. She asks, "So, why aren't you at your Ivy League school picking ivy or whatever you do?" He tells her that he needed a break from law school and she calls him a bum, but says she has nothing against bums. As he's paying the check, she saunters over to the window and looks at all the yachts lining the marina. She asks, "Which one is yours?" And he admits that the double-nosed schooner is his father's. When she turns around, he kisses her, and deeply. They break apart. She closes her eyes, and he quietly says, "Arujo." Pronounces it correctly and kisses her again. The next day, at Cat's planetarium job, it's business as usual until Tim and Phoebe arrive partway through her narrating about sailors using a sextant to navigate using the stars. Cat stumbles, losing her place, but ultimately gets it back together. However, she is visibly flustered by Tim's presence there.
And him smiling at her.
Woo! The smile of trouble. Hey, did we just happen to come by here to your work unannounced in the middle of your planetary presentation? Ha! Huh? What are the odds? It was totally on purpose. Tim! Bad man.
The girls are all back at Mystic Pizza listening to Leona punching numbers and saying, something's gotta change. Jill reminds her that business will pick up, but Leona knows that happens in June, a long ways away, and laments, tourists! Can't live with them, can't live without them. Joe then reminds Leona of her great idea of creating and serving gourmet pizzas, but Leona's against it. Her father passed down this recipe to her. Everything's traditional, from the sauce to the spices, straight from the Algarve, and if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Just then, the Fireside Gourmet Show comes on the TV. It's hosted by a pretentious man who visits local eateries and reviews their food. Cat proclaims that they should get him to visit Mystic Pizza, and the girls agree, but Leona's too proud and wouldn't even serve him if he came in. There's a short stint of the gourmet knocking a local restaurant and verbally ripping their foods to shreds. As they watch, they all have second thoughts about inviting him after all. After the show, Joe pleads with Leona to please tell her what she puts in the pizza. But Leona will not. That's a secret recipe, one she'll keep until the day she retires. And then maybe, just maybe, she'll pass it down to one of the girls. Next we see Kat. She's at the Travers house putting Phoebe to bed. As she brushes her hair, Phoebe tells her, Mommy lives in England now. Kat assures her that she'll be back in a few weeks, and Phoebe casually responds, I know, we're not getting a divorce. Kat stops dead in her tracks, and suddenly Tim appears in the doorway. He was working downstairs and caught the tail end of that comment. He apologetically tells the babysitter, I don't know where she comes up with this stuff, and takes over the bedtime duties. He begins reading Phoebe a story, and Kat bids them good night before she makes it down the stairs. Tim stops her and tells her, What does he tell her? Find out with us after the break.
We're back. Tim only stops to inform her it's cold outside.
Baby, it's cold outside.
Oh,
let me sing you this rapey song. Baby, it's cold outside.
Yes. He slowly takes off his sweater, and he takes it off in that sexy way, like in the I'm pulling it off over my head. Yes. It's sexy way.
Yes.
I was like, is the rest of your shirts coming off with that too? Because, rawr. But his performance is not for me. It's for a teenager, which not mm-hmm. nearly as cute. Mm-hmm. And he hands the sweater to her. She smiles up at him with these puppy dog love me eyes. And I'm like, oh, I recognize that look in myself. And don't do it, girl. Don't do it. And she puts the sweater on over her head. When she gets it halfway on, he helps her pull it down. They are clearly having a moment, but Phoebe calls from upstairs for her dad to come finish the story. And Kat is feeling some feels as she goes out the door. And Leona, you can still have your original recipe pizza and do interesting pizza takes. In addition, I'm just saying this all. Jojo has a good idea.
Okay.
But me bringing that up now would ruin the sexual tension.
The pizza can be part of the sexual tension. She's talking about white wine and clams. Clams are sexy.
So sexy and rubbery. Oh, and rubbers. Sex. Yeah, totally works. She scooters home, and before she goes inside, Daisy and Charlie arrive in his Porsche. And they share a passionate kiss in the driveway. This movie would make us change our podcast name from One Dry Kiss to Many, Many Deep Kisses. Hallmark movie, this is not. Although sexy times are merely implied beyond kisses. Cat watches them kiss. Perhaps a little envious? Upstairs, Daisy notices Cat's new sweater. And as a big sister is wont to do, asks, whose sweater is that? Her sister casually admits that it's Tim's. And Daisy remarks, oh, it's Tim now. I think he's trying to put the moves on you. Cat tells Daisy, you're disgusting. And Daisy agrees as she gleefully goes into her room, rummaging around in a drawer, and pulls out a box of condoms. She giggles as she throws it at Cat, telling her, the guy puts this on. Cat looks disgusted when she realizes what it is and throws it back at Daisy. Daisy dodges the flying condom box, and the box hits the wall behind her, narrowly avoiding hitting a sculpture of praying hands that is hanging on the wall. If anyone's having sex in this house, it's more likely to be Daisy than Cat. Or is it?
Psh, I'm not surprised she didn't go bend over and pick it up and be like, I'm going to need these later anyway, so
bye. No. I was like, this whole interchange too, I was like, Denise and Tam, like that would totally be happening.
Oh, I would totally, like, if I was Cat, I'd be like, I'm holding on to these just in case, because the last thing I wanted to do in any part of my late teens or early 20s was go get condoms, because you know when you went up to the counter, somebody's looking at you going, mm-hmm, you're having sex soon. So every time I had to go to Planned Parenthood for whatever reason and they had that nice little bowl of condoms at the front counter, I was filling up my big purse, let me tell you that. Wasn't having all the sex. Was just very prepared for the little amount of sex I was having.
That's good. It helps you out in the future and also explains why you had a giant purse just in case so that you could have your like gumball machine's worth of condoms in there.
Absolutely.
Next, we see Charlie driving Daisy to his family's summer cottage, which is a house that's 10 times the size of Daisy's and sits right next to the ocean. She marvels at its grandeur as they make their way inside. In the living room, everything is dark, and Charlie begins lighting candles. Daisy playfully asks, what's the matter? Can't afford your light bill? He informs her that his father turns off the electricity when no one's here. She's confused. Doesn't he know that you're here? He confirms he does, but he'd rather not be reminded. He starts a fire and Daisy asks, is this your move, bringing all the townie girls to your family's big, beautiful house? He quietly says, it's not, because this is the first person he's brought here. He puts his focus on the fire and has his back to her when she asks, how's it going so far? He says, good, and asks, how are you liking it? But there's no response. Daisy is gone, and in her place is a lone stiletto shoe, or as I like to call them, a Hallmark heel, because while nobody outside of the 80s was wearing those shoes, in Hallmark movies, they still do.
They're timeless in Hallmark land.
Uh-huh. Seriously. Charlie takes the candle and picks it up while she calls from upstairs. Hey, Junior, follow the breadcrumbs. Cue sexy saxophone music.
Who in the 80s designated the saxophone as the sexy instrument? That's what I want to know.
Oh.
Because it's not. In hindsight, it's really, really not.
It's like a big curvy dick, you know, super sexy.
It's phallic and you put your mouth on it. It's solely sexual.
Uh-huh. And also makes me think about Night Court. The opening sequence to Night Court has a whole saxophone.
Oh, yes. Yes, it did. Yeah. Yes, it did.
Made you think it was a completely different kind of show. And then you're like, oh, what kind of crime show is this? And it's like, oh, no, it's a sitcom. Okay.
Yeah.
So sexy saxophone music. Charlie makes his way to the second floor. Her articles of clothing are thrown here and there, hither and thither, if you will. The last being her chemise that is dangling on the doorknob, a word that we have recently become intimately acquainted with, which we never thought we would be acquainted with, chemise. And yet, I have seen so many movies with chemises in them within this past year. He opens the door to find her wearing a large men's button-up shirt, standing in a mostly empty bedroom. All the furniture is covered except for a four-post king-sized bed. He tells her, "This is my parents' room, and that's my father's shirt." Daisy knows exactly what she's doing and asks, "Do you think he'll miss it?" Charlie responds softly, "No." And they kiss sultrily. Cut to the two of them post-coital, snuggling in his parents' bed. Charlie looks bothered as Daisy blissfully nestles against his chest. He finally tells her, "You know how I said I'm taking a break from law school? That's not really true. I was actually kicked out for cheating on a final." She asks, "Why'd you cheat?" And he admits, "The pressure was too great." And seeing as how he's Chuck Windsor's son, Daisy looks at him intently and says, "You lied. I'm glad you told me, but don't ever do that again." He looks at her relieved and asks, "Which, lie or cheat?" She responds, "Either." He kisses her again, and it's clear that they're going in for round two. Ding, ding, ding. Cue sexy saxophone solo.
The next section is the only one I labeled in this whole outline, and I call it "Everybody's Trying to Get Some Love."
Ooh, and I was like, that is aptly labeled.
Meanwhile, at the Travers residence, Kat has dragged the Von Kort telescope onto the patio. Meanwhile, I did look up a Von Kort telescope to see exactly how much they cost, and they could range anywhere from $4,000 to $10,000, depending on how big they are.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, now. So when I looked it up in today's money, like, there was one Van Kort website where he had like two listed, and one was $4,000 and one was $9,000. And I was like, oh, okay, I wouldn't be letting her drag that out to my patio, but different times. Kat is gazing at the sky when Tim comes home. She tells him that she was just stargazing and she could hear Phoebe from the patio. "Hope that's okay." Tim says it's fine, goes inside and pours himself a glass of wine. Kat can see him through the window, and when he offers her a drink, some juice or soda, she not casually, asks for a glass of wine. He's surprised, but obliges. They stand on the patio, chatting and drinking. Her descriptions of the constellations prompt him to look through the telescope as she waxes poetic about the stars and constellations. She tells him, "It's the perfect night to watch for comets, too, because it's a clear sky and a new moon." Tim stands entirely too close to her and proposes a toast. They both lift their glasses as he says, "Well, then, here's to clear skies, new moons, and comets." Across town, Joe and Bill are making out on her family's living room floor. It's empty in there. Her family's not in there, by the way. It's just them.
They're not all sitting down and, like, watching Leave It to Beaver while...
watching Night Court.
Yes. While the two of them make out.
Huh. Yeah. No. Let me be clear. They are alone, it's dark, and the living room floor. They're about to get busy when Bill notices a glowing Jesus statue in the corner and says, "I can't do it with him staring at me." Joe proposes that they go upstairs to her room, but Bill argues that her parents are up there. She assures him that they're asleep, but his conscience has gotten the best of him, and he tries to leave. She stops him at the door and asks for one last kiss, and he obliges, and she turns it into an opportunity to air out his winky, a.k.a. start giving him a blowy, and a.k.a. try to get him to stay. When he pleads for her to make a commitment saying, "We love each other, why can't we just get married?" She gets upset and tells him, "If you say married one more time, I'm going to scream." He looks at her seriously and says, "Marry me, Joe." And sure enough, Joe screams, "Ah!"
I don't think she really thought that through.
No, she did not. Her parents come downstairs. They see the two partially clad lovers, figure out there is some canoodling going on, and a scuffle breaks out while Joe's dad tries to attack Bill for having his way with his daughter. With the think about that face, because she was the one trying to get on him. Ah, the patriarchy. Joe climbs onto her father's back in an effort to protect him, and thankfully Bill makes it out in one piece, but not before hastily telling Joe's parents goodnight. Goodnight!
As he's pulling up his pants. Yeah.
His pants and running out the door.
Oh. The next day, Joe is regaling her friends with the previous night's antics. Kat and Daisy find it hilarious, and even more so when they pass by the marina and see Bill's boat. where it previously said JoJo now has a sign that says Nympho. Fucker. I'm That's sorry.
Real funny.
That's not
real
cute.
Real funny.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Bill proudly calls out to Joe while slapping the side of the wheelhouse, asking, "You like it?" She does not. Neither do Tamara and I. She is pissed, as Tamara and I are, and yells, "I'm glad I never married you. You are such an asshole, Bill." She peppers him with more insults as his boat floats away with Bill on it as he implores her to calm down. He's like, "What? This is just a joke. What's the matter?" Ugh. Ha-ha. Super funny. Hardy har-har. But the damage is done. Oh, and by the way, Tamara, such nautical knowledge. You knew what a fucking wheelhouse was? I was like, what's a wheelhouse? I had to look it up. Good vocabulary there.
I actually learned what a wheelhouse was from a Hallmark movie.
I was wondering.
Bell.
Yes.
Bell ringing one.
Yes.
Yeah. They went into the wheelhouse and I was like, so thank you, Hallmark, for teaching me that word.
With the triangle of pain. Ding, ding, ding. Every yes. time a bell rings or something like that. Yeah.
Yes. We covered that movie. I learned the word wheelhouse. I'm using it again. Thanks, dictionary.
And I promptly forgot it. Sorry, dictionary. Yes. So it's so funny, though. Once I looked it up and it was like, that's where the wheel of the ship is. I was like, oh, and suddenly I too thought of that movie and I was like, I wonder if that's where she got it from. I don't know, but I'm impressed anyways. Good on you. That night in retaliation, Daisy, Kat, and Joe find Bill's truck at the local watering hole. Joe steals his spare key and the trio go for a joyride. They drive through the small town blaring Aretha Franklin's R-E-S-P-E-C-T, the only song of any kind of goodness in this movie, thank you very much. And loudly sing along. They decide to end their evening at the country club and park by the clubhouse. There's an event in full swing and the girls drink beers while Daisy and JoJo do the jitterbug to the live music that's blaring from inside. Kat looks at the people dancing, and amongst the event's crowd is Charlie, who's leading around a pretty blonde. Kat's face falls, and when she lets Daisy know, Daisy shakes her fist at the sky, yelling, "Curse your son, but inevitable betrayal!" He was supposed to be out of town all weekend visiting his 90-year-old grandmother, fucker! The girls try to talk her off the ledge, but Daisy is enraged. She snatches the keys to Bill's truck and drives it right alongside Charlie's Porsche. The convertible top is down, and she proceeds to dump two huge barrels of Bill's fish and seawater into Charlie's car just as he's coming out of the clubhouse. He screams, "Hey, that's my car!" before being attacked and pummeled by Daisy. He pins her arms to her side and introduces the blonde. "Daisy, this is my sister, Serena Windsor. Serena, this is Daisy Arujo, the girl I was telling you about." Daisy, realizing her mistake, sheepishly says, "Hi," but then gets shouty again, accusing Charlie, "Why didn't you tell me you were back in town?" He informs her that my grandmother had a migraine and I tried calling you, but you were out. She finally relents, the incident probably sobering her up a bit, and admits, "I fucked up." He agrees, but adds, "Yeah, but you gave it 100%. This causes her to chuckle, and she calls him weird. He balks. "I'm weird. I'm the weird one." He's surprisingly understanding, and they hug as he calmly asks if she can give him a lift back into town because his car is going to need some serious detailing before it is drivable again.
It's so funny because I think one of the best little moments of acting was by Charlie's sister, Serena, because I didn't put it in there, but He's like, "This is Daisy Arujo, the girl I was telling you about." And she kind of has her hands out. And she's like, "Daisy, hi." Like, what the fuck? What a way to meet somebody. And so when I was trying to figure out her name, I looked her up on IMDb. And this is like the only movie that she ever did, which I thought was interesting. So I was like, oh, that was like a good little bit of acting. And she never did anything after this movie.
Well, she was good, too, at the dinner table. Like, her facial expressions were, like, spot on.
Yeah. The next morning, Joe hurries to the marina to catch Bill's boat before it sets out for the day. She apologizes to him for stealing his car, and we have another super understanding male who tells her, "That's okay. Stole my car? That's okay. You dumped seawater and sludge into my car? That's okay." These guys are surprisingly cavalier about their cars. Before pointing out that he changed the sign on the back of his boat, it now reads JoJo again. She also has great news and excitedly tells him that her sister's going out of town this weekend and they can use her apartment as a love shack. Bill hesitates a moment before saying, "I'm not interested." And she can't understand. They can have alone time for 3 whole days. But Bill's done. He's tired of sneaking around his parents' house. Her parents' house is the bathroom at Mystic Pizza, for God's sakes. He wants all of Joe and thinks if they love each other, they should get married. She disagrees. And he's tired of just being her dick cycle and breaks it off. If he can't have all of Joe in holy matrimony, he doesn't want any of her. She sadly watches him sail away in disbelief because they're over? Question mark. And next we see Joe going into work. Everyone's there. Cat, Daisy, Leona, Mr. Leona. And they watch her surprised as she starts setting up tables for the day. When Joe asks, "What are you looking at? What gives?" They explain it's because she's 3 hours early. Joe knows she's early and informs the Mystic crew that her and Bill just broke up. Cat and Daisy are surprised and probably wonder if it's due to the car theft. But Joe explains that it was just their differences. She loves Bill, doesn't want to marry him, so he should wait for her. But conversely, she loves him and maybe she should marry him because that's what he wants. She talks in circles about the breakup, but phrases it as if she was the one doing the breaking up instead of the other way around. She assures herself that she has plenty of prospects ahead of her, looks seriously at her boss and asks, "Leona, when you retire, you're going to tell me what's in that pizza and I could take over this place." Leona agrees, when she retires. And Joe finds solace in this and continues to bust tables while thanking everyone for their great advice, in spite of no one really saying anything, before she gets teary-eyed and excuses herself to the restroom. All the ladies follow her, but not before Leona gives Mr. Leona a knowing look and huffs, "Ha! Men!"
Ha! The next day, Kat is at the Travers house babysitting, a.k.a. reading a book, while Phoebe fishes standing at the end of the dock. Cool, cool, cool. I guess you'll hear a splash if she falls in. Tim comes home early and notices Phoebe in a good mood. Kat says, "That's because she's excited that her mom's coming home." Kat asks, "What's Mrs. Travers like?" And Tim tells her their origin story. They met freshman year at Yale, and he can't believe that Kat is about to dive into that same college world, and he muses on how excited she must be. She's also excited, but sees how nice it is to have a family like he has. He tells her cryptically that things sometimes happen, then asks if she needs to get to her other job at Mystic Pizza. She flippantly says they'll cover for her, and they spend the rest of the evening talking by the fire, eating popcorn, while Phoebe plays close by. Meanwhile, back at Mystic, Daisy is in a tizzy because she was supposed to meet Charlie's parents that night. Ha 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 ha. But since Kat didn't show up, she has to stay at work. She tries calling the Travers house, but Phoebe, who is playing by herself off to the side in the room, has taken the phone off the hook. When Charlie comes by to pick up Daisy, he is understanding of her predicament and says they'll do it a different time. Daisy doesn't want his parents to think that she blew them off, especially his mom, though. Charlie strokes her face and says matter-of-factly, "The sexiest, sexiest thing a man can say to a woman. Don't worry, my mom doesn't think."
That's hot.
Uh-huh. Super, super hot. So Tamara says, "Wow, that's telling." And I say, "I always pay attention to how men I date speak about the women in their lives. And that's not a cute look, Charlie. Not a cute look." At the end of the shift, Daisy's mopping the floors in the empty restaurant when Kat finally shows up. Kat apologizes and tries helping with the closing chores, but her sister is giving her the cold shoulder. Kat, tired of being ignored, finally tells her sister, "Stop being such a bitch. You unload your shifts on me all the time." And Daisy reminds her that she had dinner plans with Charlie's parents that evening. Kat's face falls. She completely forgot and apologizes again. And I get it, but also, Daisy is always pawning everything off on Kat, so fuck right off.
But Daisy is incensed. You're pathetic, Daddy boffing the babysitter, tale as old as time. What the hell do you guys even talk about? Do you really think this 30-year-old man is going to leave his wife and live with you happily ever after? You're living in a fucking romance novel. This hits a nerve, and Kat yells back, "Oh, sure, boffing, fucking, screwing. Nobody knows that better than the wise Daisy. Why don't you start taking cash for your services? It would be more honest." This rightfully pisses off Daisy. She puts the mop down and slaps her sister's face before telling her, "Wipe your conscience." But what I think would have been the better move if she had taken that funky string mop and slapped her face with the string mop and then said, "Wipe your conscience," because then it would have been doubly powerful. It would have been downright punny. And also really gross. Then Daisy is done. She grabs her jacket and leaves the restaurant in a huff.
In a half. The next day during work, Kat and Daisy are still at odds when Kat asks Joe to babysit Phoebe. What?
I know, I was confused.
Isn't that your job? Yeah. Daisy practically sneers at this and says, "Oh, how ironic. A babysitter for the babysitter?" Joe ignores Daisy and agrees. And we cut to that night where Joe is sitting at the Travers house by the fire with the sleeping Phoebe in her arms, singing her a lullaby. Meanwhile, Tim and Kat are at the Elias Montrose house. It's raining outside, so this is the only place they can have their little picnic. They spread out a blanket, put down a pizza, and sit across from each other. They're flirting back and forth when there's a creaking board right outside the window on the haunted patio. They both stop, look at each other, and say simultaneously, "Did you hear that?" They both nervously laugh and simultaneously say, "Elias Montrose!" Or rather, his ghost. Kat playfully smacks him on the chest, and he catches her wrist and brings her close to him. They kiss passionately and start undressing each other. And we don't get to see anything, but they cut to again after the deed, where they're giddily driving back to Tim's house. Once they park, Tim tells Kat not to move because he wants to rush over to her side and hold his coat over her head, all chivalrous-like, so she won't get any wetter on the way inside. When they tumble through the front doors, Tim has his arm around Kat's waist and they're giggling like teenagers. They look up to see Joe, who has a shocked expression on her face, and she asks measuredly, "Hey, Kat, did you make it to your mom's okay to give her the medicine?" Kat looks confused until she notices Joe's eyes dart in the direction of another lady who's in the room. She introduces herself. It's Nikki Travers, who's back early from England. Tim slowly goes over to his wife, greets her with a kiss on the cheek. Well, Mrs. Travers says how fond Phoebe is of Kat and how much help she's been. The whole time Mrs. Travers is speaking, Kat and Tim are making eyes at each other. Hers are saying, "Aren't you going to tell her about us?" While his are saying, "Sorry, I'm just a horny asshole who is using her for fox and to boost my own fragile ego. And, FYI, I'm not leaving my wife and family." Wah, wah, wah. Kat looks near tears while she tells Mrs. Travers that Phoebe is a very special little girl and she's glad she could help. Joe, realizing that they should get while the getting's good, says goodnight, grabs Kat, and heads out the door. But they're stopped by Mrs. Travers, who won't let them go. Without paying them.
Uh-huh.
Joe protests that she doesn't need money, but only for a moment before she grabs the cash and quickly leaves with a rattled Kat following behind.
Oh, it's so heartbreaking. On their way home in Kat's family's used mail Jeep, Joe nervously babbles on about whether or not Mrs. Travers was on to them. She says, "I mean, you guys had your arms around each other, but maybe your mom was really sick and he was just being nice. People are like that. She might know, though. She looks really smart. Holy shit, Kat, you don't think she'll come after you or anything? Oh, God, I thought I had problems. I mean, with Bill, you know what you're getting. Not like that gutless wonder back there. He makes Bill look like a catch of all time." The whole time she's talking, Kat sits in stunned silence, her eyes glassy with tears and disbelief. Kat finally makes it home, and when she gets to the top of the stairs, Daisy is in the bathroom brushing her teeth and verbally rips into her sister, "Can you not wear my boots, please? I'd like to keep them nice. And don't use my comb either. It was so full of scuzz, I could barely use it." I was like, that scuzz is your hair. Your super curly, super long hair. Not your sister's cute little bob hair that's straight. But regardless, Kat wordlessly goes into her room and closes the door because that's beside the point. Daisy knocks and sarcastically asks, You still alive? But when she doesn't get a response, she opens the door to find her sister on her bed, sobbing and soaking wet. Daisy immediately softens and rushes to her sister's side, because that's what good sisters do. Even if they're fucking pissed about something, they are still there for their sister. Asking her what's wrong, Kat tearfully regales her with the evening's events. And when we got home and she was there, he didn't even look at or say anything to me. I just feel so stupid. And I say, Kat, you were a teenager being exploited by a married man. Doesn't matter how smart you are, stupid emotional mistakes are bound to happen. Daisy embraces her and murmurs, it may not feel like it now, but you will be all right. Kat looks up in disbelief and wails, then why does it hurt so bad? Daisy tries to get up to make her sister a cup of tea, but Kat grabs her arm like a lifeline and begs her, just stay. Daisy obliges and gently cradles her sister's head to her chest while Kat wails in agony.
Oh, I was like, beep.
As that works.
Tears.
Oh, the next day at work, Kat is out of it. She's getting orders wrong, taking uncooked pizzas out to tables. Everyone's annoyed, but they rally, knowing that she's going through some shit. She greets a man at a table without looking up, and a familiar voice orders, the Mystic Pizza, please. It's the Fireside Gourmet at their restaurant? She asks him if he would like anything else, but he only requires a clean glass of water. He picks up the one off his table to reveal a set of dentures soaking inside of it. She quickly whisks it away and hurries in the back to tell Leona, the food critic is here! And Leona, you need to make the best Mystic Pizza you've ever made! But Leona acts nonplussed, motions to a line of already made pizza, and directs Kat, pick one, whatever one you want. She does. And then we see how Leona truly feels. Once she's alone in the kitchen, she starts emphatically making the sign of the cross and praying to the heavens. Kat brings the pizza to the Fireside Gourmet. He takes a couple of tentative bites, jots a few things down in his notebook, and takes a few more before looking up and seeing the entire staff of Mystic staring at him. He motions Kat over and asks for the bill. She tries to upsell him on some fresh clams or a nice small house salad, but he declines, pays, and leaves. Also leaving the entire pizza pie, minus few bites, behind. The Mystic employees look at the abandoned pie with dismay, because if he liked it, he would have taken it, right? Leona gets upset and loudly says, somebody should shove a squid up the Fireside Gourmet's ass.
The next day, Daisy is rooting around in the fridge at home for something to eat, but all there is lobster, like multiple giant lobsters just chilling in the fridge, waiting for their puppet show moment. She mumbles under her breath. All we ever eat is lobster. Lobster for breakfast, lobster lunch, and dinner. Later, when she and her mom are leaving the house, Daisy giddily says, I'm not going to be able to drive you to the potluck tomorrow. I'm going to meet Charlie's parents. Mom is unresponsive and continues shoving items into her bag before dismissively saying, that's fine. I'll get a ride with somebody else. Daisy wants her mom to share in her excitement, but mom is being super judgmental and informs her daughter, you know he's not going to marry you. Daisy is taken aback and exclaims, Ma, it's just dinner with his parents. Mom puts her hands on her hips and says sarcastically.
New word.
Sure. What do I know? Daisy rolls her eyes, prompting her mom to continue. Do you think I always looked like this? You don't think guys were sniffing around after me? Luckily, I had sense. Daisy glares at her mom, flustered, because she has sense. But mom retorts, you don't even have enough sense to not go jumping in the backseat of every sports car that comes along. Daisy crosses her arms and quietly but firmly says, you're really good at this, you know. Mom doesn't know, so Daisy fills her in. Good at making me feel like shit. I know I curse. I'm stupid. I'm a slut. All of those strikes against Daisy. Mom retorts, I just want you to make something of yourself. Daisy rages back. I'm not going to yell, and you're just going to have to deal with that. Mom gets quiet and says, I don't expect you to go to Yale. I'm just worried about you. Daisy's eyes get watery, and she nods her head, muttering quietly, me too.
Ugh, that's got to be so hard, that dynamic where she talks to Kat, oh, my daughter, so proud for a job, so smart, going to Yale. Daisy, you just jump in the back of every single car. I'm like, oh, that's the blatant favoritism that plays out in front of you every day has got to sting. And it would probably cause me to act out a little bit, too.
Yeah, I would say that that kind of treatment creates divisiveness, you know, because it just leads one person to feel bitter over another. It's like, it's not good. Not good.
I know a lot of families, including some close relatives, that definitely had favorites, and it was painfully obvious.
Yeah, that's hard.
The next evening, we see Daisy at Charlie's house, surrounded by the Windsor family. Daisy's dressed as if she's going to prom, while everyone else looks country club chic.
Yeah.
It's a full table with Charlie's parents, brother, sister, and a couple of aunts and uncles. There's a full dinner service, and one of the maids who brings out a plate recognizes Daisy. She's a local girl named Teresa, and they make awkward small talk until Mrs. Windsor says, "Teresa?" The warning makes the maid excuse herself quickly. They're having lobster, much to Daisy's dismay. But everyone marvels at its deliciousness, while Papa Windsor and Charlie make subtle/not-subtle digs at each other. Things are tense, especially when Teresa spills some gravy on Aunt Tweety's arm, causing the aunt to flippantly say, "Oh, these Portuguese girls, they're so hard to train."
Ugh.
She remembers who she's sitting across from and apologizes to Charlie, adding, "Oh, I didn't mean your friend, though." You could apologize directly to Daisy, but nah, that'd be too awkward. This incenses Charlie, who accuses, "Why are you talking about training? You can't even train your husband to sleep at home." Charlie's younger brother, played by a very young Matt Damon, snickers loudly, and Charlie continues, "And Dad, you're just mad because you can't train me. And if you can't train a golden boy like me, how in the world can you train a dumb Portuguese girl?"
And I say, "Charlie Chance, burn it all down," in an effort to show how down to earth he is.
Yeah. "I'm going to protect you and your people." No, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Just don't nip. Okay, your house is on fire.
Yeah.
The house is on fire, people. His father roars, "That is enough." So Charlie proclaims that dinner's over, grabs a tablecloth, knocking everyone's plates over. Daisy leaves in a huff. In a huff!
In a huff!
Saying, "Damn it, Charlie!" He follows her outside, but she's livid. Charlie defends that he couldn't let them speak to her that way. They were being jerks. But Daisy knows better. "You didn't do that for me. You did that for you. The only jerk at that table was you. Everyone else was just being themselves."
Mm-hmm.
"Sure, bring your poor Portuguese girlfriend for dinner. Shake up the family a little bit. I'm poor, and I admit it, but at least I'm not desperate. I would never use you to get back at somebody. And your father didn't shit his way out of law school. You did that all on your own. Deal with it, Junior." His face is shocked with all these truth bullets that she's shooting at him.
Pew, pew, pew.
But he doesn't say anything. So she ends her tirade with, "You're not even good enough for me." Off in the distance, she sees Teresa leaving and asks for a ride home, leaving a dumbfounded Charlie behind. I do have to say also in this scene, like, the mom, Charlie's mom, has a very small, like, inconsequential, like, part.
Uh-huh.
But she does not seem like she does not think. Like, it's not like her mom's sitting there at the head of the table going, "I don't know, honey, whatever you want to do."
Yeah.
Like, so the fact that he says that about his mom is, I'm just like, oh, Daisy. If you stay with this guy 20 or 30 years from now, he's going to be like, "That's just my stupid wife. She has no head for business or anything else."
I was like, after Charlie's performance, where he fucking clears the entire table by pulling the tablecloth off with all contents in it, and Daisy says, "Oh, fuck you very much. This was not about me. This is about you, asshole." I was like, Daisy, go. That moment was a triumphant moment. And also, Daisy, everybody knows you're smart except for you.
Yeah, seriously. That's a funny thing, though, about shows, especially around the 80s, that kind of like try to address ethnic slurs or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like usually the people that are of the ethnicity that's being slurred, they're on to most things. Yeah. Like, they've been through it. They've lived through it. They've had to smile through it, like, multiple times. And so that's why Daisy's like, your family's just being your family, and I'm just going to smile, because I'm not going to sit there and stand on the table and dictate, like, the downtrodden Portuguese fishermen that have been in this area for years and years and their plights.
Right.
So it's just like, it's just sometimes easier to just be like, whatever, I'm not going to fight against your whole fucking family to try to make a point, because chances are it's just going to be like, those Portuguese girls, they sure are strong-willed or whatever.
Ugh.
People are going to see people, sadly, in that day and age, the way they want to do it. And you can try to change their minds, but doing it at a dinner table when it's your boyfriend's relatives is probably not the best place.
Yeah. You got to pick your battles. I mean, same thing today. You've got to pick your battles about that stuff and when you talk about it and how you talk about it. Mm-hmm. Same.
A short while later, all the girls are working their shift at Mystic Pizza and Kat is out of it. Things can get worse, right? But they do. The front door jingles and it's Tim and Phoebe. He sheepishly walks over to Kat, saying that Phoebe wanted to say goodbye. Kat bends down and gives the little girl a heartfelt goodbye and tells her to keep going to the library. When she stands again, her face is a little harder and Tim stammers out a goodbye, but not before handing her a check, saying, all those stars and constellations don't come cheap. She says a polite thank you and watches them leave through the window. Mrs. Travers is waiting in the car, and they all pile in and leave like a big, happy family. Kat goes straight to the kitchen and begins tearing that fucking check up. Thank you very much. She knows this is hush money or a dirty payoff, and she wants no part of it. Joe and Daisy watch her, and when Joe realizes how much the check was for, she tries to piece it back together, saying, Kat, you can still cash it. You just need to tape it together and initial it. Daisy rubs her sister's shoulders reassuringly and informs Joe Kat doesn't need the money that bad. The girls head back into the dining room, leaving Leona and Kat alone. Leona and Kat have a tender moment. Leona asks if she's okay, and Kat crumbles, brokenhearted, into her arms. It's short-lived, though, because out in the dining room, Daisy and Joe begin screeching excitedly. Leona, Mr. Leona, and Kat join them in time to see the Fireside Gourmet give his critique of their restaurant on TV. The critic admits, the atmosphere was rustic. The service was over-solicitous. But I found the pizza to be, in a word, superb. The girls go wild. But Leona shushes them because she wants to hear what else he has to say. The gourmet tells his audience, I ordered the Mystic Pizza, and it was mystic indeed. It has exactly the right blend of cheese, tomatoes, and spices that I couldn't quite identify. Leona is absolutely beaming at the TV screen and shouts, you bet your ass you couldn't. The critic says, this sublime pizza is in Mystic, Connecticut, and I give it my highest rating. And the entire restaurant cheers. As soon as the program cuts to commercial, the restaurant phone rings. Leona answers it and chuckles heartily, telling the caller, no reservations needed, as everyone erupts into peals of laughter. Things are going to get much busier around Mystic Pizza. And it made me think about at that dinner that Charlie and Daisy were at. The family's like, oh, we love pizza. And Daisy looks at them, and just like you said, you got to choose your timing about things and when you say things. Daisy looks at them and is like, I have never once seen you in my fucking pizza restaurant. And that pizza is some of the best around.
Yes. The Fireside Gourmet says so.
Exactly.
Next, we get a close-up of Bill's face. He's sitting behind the wheel of his truck with an unreadable expression. We hear Joe's voice. I want to be absolutely clear that you understand that I need to maintain my identity. And I love you very, very much, but I still need to be my own person. Nothing has changed. To which he smirks and responds, nothing except your name. And we see that Joe is sitting beside him in her wedding dress. She gets out of the car to a barrage of friends and family that are all waiting outside to throw rice. We're at their wedding reception! Held at Mystic Pizza. Portuguese music plays as people eat, drink, celebrate, and dance. And it looked like a merry atmosphere, except for the sucky scene where they showed a couple of 9-ish-year-old boys sitting in a booth, one with the beer in his hand and the other with the cigarette. And no one seems to notice or care. Yeah, right. It's like, are they trying to really drive home the ethnicity of this family? Like, look, they're so crazy. The kids drink beer and smoke cigarettes and nobody cares.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Oh, the thinly veiled racism. Kat is in her bridesmaid's dress, dancing with Mr. Leona, when Leona cuts in. Mr. Leona asks, "You want to dance with me or Kat?" Leona snarkily says, "Not you," and leads Kat to a quiet corner where she hands her an envelope full of cash. Kat tries to refuse it, but Leona insists and tells her, "You can pay me back sometimes. You know, me and Mr. Leona, we don't have kids. Daisy, Joe, and you, you're our kids." They both get a little teary-eyed and embrace before Leona straightens up, saying semi-seriously, "Oh, you're ruining my dress," and heads back to the party. Meanwhile, across the room, Charlie crashes the reception. He's looking for Daisy. She's in the kitchen scooping chocolate ice cream into dishes when he finds her. He gives her a heartfelt apology because everything she said was right. She listens but seems unmoved, so he starts to leave dejected before she calls him back asking, "Hey, you like chocolate ice cream?" He says it's his favorite, and she saucily replies, "Then it's your lucky day." She motions for him to take a scoop, and after they fill 3 dessert bowls together, she pats him on the back and tells him to keep going and leaves.
I love it. Daisy heads outside to the back of Mystic Pizza, where she finds Kat getting air and gazing at the stars. Daisy grins happily, stating, "I knew I'd find you here." And Kat smiles back, mentioning that she noticed Daisy had a visitor, prompting her sister to smile, shrug, and proclaim, "Who knows?" They marvel at how close the holidays are and how right after that, Kat's heading to college. Daisy teases her sister, saying, "Do me a favor. Next time you date a Yalie, make sure he's your age." They chuckle as Joe barrels out to join them, holding a champagne bottle, 2 glasses, and gushing, "You're not going to believe what Bill's mom just asked me. She says, when am I going to hear some good news? Jesus, I've been married 2 hours. She wants me knocked up already." They all laugh as Joe pours them both a glass of champagne, saying, "I really love you guys." They all cheers and take a drink, Joe taking a pull straight from the bottle. They sit in contemplative silence before Joe looks out into the darkness and says, "You know what I really wonder? What the hell does Leona put in that pizza?" They all break into fits of laughter and hug as the camera pans out into darkness and as a syrupy song plays. I don't remember the melody. It was horrible. But I know we'll be friends for life. But I didn't listen to the rest because I had enough 80s hits, and this was no hit. It was on par with the saxophone solos throughout the movie, except maybe worse because the lyrics were so fucking barfy. That having been said, Miss Tamara, how many dry kisses do you give Mystic Pizza? Oh, the end. Mystic.
Yes. The end. Oh, Mystic Pizza. You are the bad piece of cold pizza that's in my fridge for a couple of days, but I'm going to eat you on the third day because you're there and you're still pretty good, but you're stale and not as good as when you first were hot and fresh, aka the 80s. So, although I love this movie, it's some of it doesn't hold up. Like, it's the same thing that we've talked about before, where you have those warm, gooey feels towards, like, the love story, and then in hindsight you're like, ah.
Yeah.
And the things that are said, like the flippant phrases, like, "My mom doesn't think," and I'm just like, "Oh, sweet baby Jesus." Just kind of like knock down the love interests a couple of pegs. And the fact that everybody in here was supposed to be Portuguese, but I don't think not one of them were.
Yeah.
Maybe Miss Arujo was.
It's possible that some of the parents were, or maybe they were Italian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. it's really hard to find Portuguese in that side of the country. So just get some Italians. It's fine. Nobody will notice. Nobody will notice. But, you know, like some of the scenes were kind of meandering and didn't really play into the plot point. Like, I think it could have been a little bit better written. I still like it, though. Like I said, it's like that piece of pizza that's stuck to the back of your fridge that you'll still eat. But I'm just going to give it a solid 3 dry kisses. Definitely worth a watch. I don't know if it's like in my arsenal, if I'm going to watch it every time it comes on, but it's a solid favorite of mine for the time and the day and the age. Granted, now very problematic in the future, but you know, you like what you like, and it was the 80s, and sometimes we just have to give it a little pass for the times. Corinne, what do you give it?
So, yeah, not diverse at all, and problematic love story, and also I can't help but still feel all the feels that I felt before. Oh, he's so dreamy. Oh, he's not dreamy, Corinne. Yes, he is. No, he's not.
Are you arguing with your younger self?
I am arguing with my current day self for still thinking he's dreamy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 3.5 dry kisses. I still find this movie so resonant. Kat and I, we could hang out together. And yeah, she'll...
Daisy and Denise could hang out together.
So yeah, it's 3.5 dry kisses for me. And that's what I'm going to say, because I felt for Kat, and it was a resonant movie for me, but also all of the stuff that you stated, which is problems. Yes. You know, it gets knocked down half a star for that end song alone.
Yeah, you know what? It started at 5 dry kisses, and every time a bad song came on this movie, I knocked it down 1. That's how I got to 3.
Yeah. Oh, there's another saxophone solo. Mm.
This is the sound of my rating going down.
So, Miss Tamara, what do we have coming up next week?
Well, Corinne, I am excited to say that we have a new theme, because it's a new month.
Ooh, I am so excited. What month would that be?
It's October.
Is that spooky month?
Yes. Yes. October is spooky month. It sure is.
Okay.
And our theme is super normal sweeties.
That super normal sweeties? That doesn't sound very like Halloween-y, spooky. I mean, if you're super normal, then you're just like really normal.
Hold on. Wait. Oh. Nope. Sorry, I misread that. It's supernatural paranormal sweeties. Ooh. That's what we're doing in October.
Well, then, I think that the movie that I was thinking about doing will fit perfectly under this umbrella. Not super normal, because it wasn't super normal at all.
Your movie that you're doing next that falls completely and beautifully, perfectly into this category is Edward Scissorhands.
With Vincent Price. Oh, Vincent Price. We love you.
Only Vincent Price. He's the main character in the whole thing. Nobody else is in it.
Nobody else is in it. It's a one-man play. It's amazing. If you have anything you'd like to say about Vincent Price, how problematic Johnny Depp is these days. Mystic Pizza. How problematic one of the love relationships was in that. Anything else you can, or inform us about how very Portuguese everybody was in that movie. You can reach out to us via email at onedrykiss@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us via the social medias, Instagram, Twitter X, or Facebook, all at One Dry Kiss.
And that's one spelled O-N-E. And as always, if you could please write us a review. If you have the time, because I'm going to sing a bad song that doesn't even rhyme, because this movie had so many bad songs. So I'll add one more. And if you write us a review, we'll thank you some more. But in the meantime, we thank you for dropping by, and we bid you adieu with One dry kiss. Mwah. See you next time.
See you next time.
See your faded sign at the side of the road. It's like 15 miles to the Love Shack. This movie would have been greatly improved by that song. Love Shack, yeah.
But that was released a year later. They should have released it a year, or they should have invented that song a year sooner.
Yes.
Do better, B-52s.
Do better.